Hello and welcome to Celebrating Cinema, a podcast for the love of cinema. Make sure to subscribe and leave us a review to help more people find us. With an almost unbelievably big repertoire of roles under his belt, the moment has come for us on this podcast to talk about arguably the most unapologetically performative actors of our time, who has divided many audiences over his war against naturalism. I am talking, of course, about none other than Nicolas Cage and the seemingly ever-lingering question of whether his performances can be classified as good or bad. I am your host, Sophie, joined by my co-hosts, our resident film programmer, Tom.
Hello.
And resident film critic, Hugo.
Hey, what's up?
And before we jump into this conversation, as always, I want to ask you what you have been watching lately.
I have a crazy thing because it's not a film but a book, but it's a very kind of...
Cheating.
Yeah, it's cheating. But it's a very cinematic book because it's about cinema as well. It's by a filmmaker called Stanley Stinter, who made a book called Last Movies, which traces all of these historical figures, mostly celebrities and filmmakers and actors, but also, for instance, like JFK and Franz Kafka. And he traces the last film that they saw before they died. And maps these connections between their lives and that film and the content of that film and how it kind of sometimes overlaps or sometimes contrasts or sometimes complements almost how they passed away. It's morbidly funny and there's some really interesting insights in it. And it links so many interesting things from film history and history in general. Like there's a way that he links Franz Kafka to Charlie Chaplin to Stanley Kubrick through the last films that they saw before they died, which just it's an entry point into talking about all these people, unveiling kind of a hidden morbid connection, and I'm enjoying it a lot.
What is the oddest movie that anybody is like? Is it JFK's last movie was watching was?
JFK's last movie was a James Bond film, which is very funny. And then in the book, he also immediately goes to what Oswald's last film was, who was the JFK assassin, which is very funny because that's the film.
Which was the Zapruder film.
Yeah. Well, there's also a bit in it about Zapruder, and there's like some of it is very tragic. Some of it is very funny in this kind of like droll, sad way. For instance, there's a bit about Charlie Parker, the you know, jazz saxophonist, and he dies while kind of watching television. So that's very sad because it's like the 50s and he's just kind of like totally fucked up and watching TV. And then it shows that after his death, he was always kind of, it was always very tragic. Like there's a very funny sentence where it's like, he was like I think a tenor saxophonist. And then on his gravestone, they put a saxophone and it's an alto saxophone.
So he was
always mistreated in life. But it's a very ironic book, but it's very well written and very playful. And it's probably the funnest film book that I've read in a long time. So I just, it's a bit of cheating, but it has so many films in it that I kind of had to mention it.
That's nice. Yeah. What about you, Tom?
I watched the film that Hugo really likes. As far as your letterbox is concerned, for the first time in my life, I saw The Color of Pomegranates from beginning to end.
Oh, yay.
Which was, this is the second podcast episode where I'm talking about a film that I saw in a cinema and the cinema was Rialto. So I'm really, really bringing money to subsidize theaters.
Shout out to...
What an amazing experience. How strange is it to have a film that has no, how do you say that in English? No handvaten.
Yeah, no handles. it's a film, if you watch it for the first time on like without knowing what he's aiming at, it just washes over you in a beautiful way. I remember watching it for the first time. I'm writing about that as well. Like, it's so hard to grasp it.
Yeah.
But that is also a very interesting experience.
Yeah. So it's the life of the Armenian poet Shayat Nova, right? So that's what it's about. It's 74 minutes of pure symbolism, in a sense, without really... So he shows you his life, but through his poetry as well, and like half of it you don't really understand what's going on. And at the same time, me and my girlfriend were standing at our bikes, and I said to her, I have the feeling I haven't understood anything, but I know everything about Armenian culture now.
Yeah, that's perfectly put. I wouldn't be able to describe like, it better.
Oh, I've that's learned so much, yeah. But I'm not sure really what. But it was a beautiful experience. And it reminded me a lot about the guy who was sitting next to me fell asleep like in the first 5 minutes. And I had to think about my favorite Apichapong Veresatakul quote again. If your response to slow cinema is to fall asleep, well, that's a fine emotion to have.
Yeah.
And you, Sophie?
I wanted to share two moments that I had in the cinema because they were beautiful. They were so small, but so beautiful to me because I was here in Lab, of course. Where am I ever somewhere else? I was here to see The Boy and the Heron. And in the beginning of the film, there's this scene where Mahito, the main character, he sneaks out of his bedroom to look at the front door from the top of the stairs to see if his dad already came home. And then his dad comes in and walks to his new wife and they're saying hi to each other. And then Mahito kind of really slowly crawls back to his room so that they don't hear that he is awake and that he's at the top of the stairs. And at the moment that he is doing this, you see him just very slowly crawling backwards. There were two girls coming back into the cinema room in that way where if you walk in front of the screen, you kind of slouch forward and you sneak in. And this was happening at the same time. And it was just so funny to me. But I was there on my own, so I couldn't share it with someone else. And then a week later, I was at IFFR to see Melk, Stephanie Kolk's new film. And there was this one scene where the camera is static, but there's people running from the right of the screen to the left of the screen. Like there's this stream of people running. And right at that moment, there was someone who ran past the screen to leave the cinema room. And the fact that it happened again a week later, and again I was there by myself, and I didn't have anyone to share that with. It was, I don't know, it was really funny, and
that's
it just made
me
laugh.
We have this podcast, yes. You know, so you can share it.
I'm
here.
Sharing it with you.
That's fantastic.
During the Color of Pomegranates screening, I realized the thing that I think about a lot when I'm in screenings, and people move before the screen, and because we have a lot of space in front of our screens, you can't really get away with it. There's too much space for you to traverse. So everybody who sneaks in front of the screen, they're there. Yeah. They're taking over your viewing experience. But I realized during Color of Pomegranates that everybody's like goes the, and this is a nice bridge to Nicolas Cage, does the Max Schreck Nosferatu wall.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So
exactly.
they crawl in front of the screen, which draw so much attention to you.
Hunchback style,
and
yeah.
Like there was a couple coming into the Color of the Color of Pomegranates. I think 15 minutes late, and the guy was doing the crawl, and the girl was so well. She was so confident that she just, in this sort of haze of arrogance, just glided in front of the screen. And nobody saw her. And I was like, yeah, you should just do it with confidence. I'm just walking here.
It's like with extras in the background of like a film or a TV series where it's like, just be totally normal and nobody notices you. And then people stop being normal.
Yeah.
Well, and that is a very good bridge to our main subject of today.
Yes, absolutely.
From your A, B, C's to not the B's. From the snakeskin jacket that represents individual freedom to I am a prickly pear. For over decades, Nicolas Cage has been a goldmine for countless memes, jokes and impressions. But besides the apparent comedic aspect of his unforgettable film performances, Cage has carved out a truly singular cinematic space as an actor, performing in some of the most endearing, incredible and weirdly fascinating movies of our times. As the master of the nouveau shamanic acting style, Cage is one of a kind. His performances are heavily stylized, expressionistic, over the top, instantly recognizable as those of Nicolas Cage, but also still layered, sensitive, smart, and sincere. Cage can take a good film and make it a masterpiece, just like he can take a bad film and make it, well, fun to watch. He has worked with film auteurs like the Coen brothers, Mike Figgis, Michael Bay, John Woo, Brian De Palma, Oliver Stone, Ridley Scott, Martin Scorsese, the late Norman Jewison, and of course his uncle Francis Ford Coppola, to name just a few. But he's also the star of countless trash films that in some cases probably only exist for certain tax write-off reasons. Maybe because of these inherent contradictions in a filmography that spans over 120 titles, he's one of the most iconic movie stars ever, with an oeuvre that's endlessly fascinating to dissect and revisit. I can know, because when I started my writing as an aspiring film critic, I had a Tumblr blog called Caged Cinema, in which I reviewed every Nicolas Cage movie released up to that point. And I believe that this experience has opened me up to so many different types of films, from gas station dollar bin schlock to instant classics, that it changed how I was hardwired as a cinephile and a film professional. Nicolas Cage makes you appreciate the quirks of cinema, the heavily stylized moments, the silly stuff, the unconventional approach. His nonconformity is a breath of fresh air in a mainstream film culture that seems increasingly sanitized and corporately controlled. That's the quintessential quality of this guy. You simply can't cage the Cage. Something as pure as Nicolas Cage doesn't come by that often in the movies, and you could say he connects our times to those of Buster Keaton, Charlie Chaplin, The Three Stooges, or Elvis Presley. When he was cast for Francis Ford Coppola's majorly underrated Rumblefish, he wasn't cast because he was Coppola's nephew, but because he could evoke a long-gone era of 50s Americana. And as a matter of fact, the surname Cage was a way for Nicolas to lose his association with Uncle Coppola, allowing him to carve out his own path in Hollywood. As such, Nicolas Cage is a window into the world of cinema, an icon of the big screen, an acting guru, and a living and breathing meme. He's also one of my personal heroes and an artist whose films I can endlessly revisit. So it's just my luck, as Nicolas Cage is also the subject of an upcoming Lab 111 retrospective, fittingly called Nicolas Uncaged, which offers some of the best Cage movies for you to enjoy. So let's put the bunny back in the box and uncage the Cage by diving into our personal relationship with the man, the meme, the myth, and the legend.
Boom.
Boom. So I wanted to begin, Tom, with asking you why Cage now? And also, as a film programmer, often you program, you know, retrospectives of filmmakers or of eras of cinema. But to have this focus on such a specific actor and what it's like to try to capture all these multitudes that I described of this actor that has over 120 films.
Yeah, I mean, there are a couple of things at play here. The first one would be that, and she'd probably like this, is that the guest on our previous episode, Laura, had been putting on Vampire's Kiss on our suggestions board for over 2 or 3 years. And now she can finally see it. But I thought there had to be a reason to feature that film. Dream Scenario is now coming out, the new film by Christoph Borgli, the guy who made Sick of Myself, where the premise of the film is that everybody dreams about a guy played by Nicolas Cage.
Why does the zebra look the way it does?
So embarrassing.
Hey, focus.
Is this how it went?
No, it's different now.
Paul, you've been on my mind recently.
Yeah?
Because you keep popping up in my dreams. You don't do anything, you're just there.
So, this specific person, the remarkable nobody.
I've also had that experience.
Do you have a picture?
Have you been dreaming about me?
Have I been dreaming about you?
Yeah.
So also the perfect film to do a retrospective around, because it is about everybody thinking about one man.
If this were ever to happen in real life, I would immediately believe that it was Nicolas Cage.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah, it makes complete sense.
Yeah.
You were talking about his sort of memification, or the way he has become this butt of a joke almost, that there was also something inside me personally that I was thinking, like, maybe this is a good time to actually watch his films and study his body of work.
not performatively as a joke, but as actual artistic effort.
Exactly. Like, we're not screening The Wicker Man to put emphasis on the bees.
What is that? What is that? What is it? Oh, no, no, not the bees! Not the bees! Ah! Oh, no, my eyes! My eyes! Ah! Ah!
We could have done that, but I myself also just wanted to have an overview of what he meant, because, like, in the 90s, films like Face Off.
I've been chasing this guy ever since I joined the force. He has no conscience, and he shows no remorse. He's the mastermind behind numerous bombings and political assassinations. He has a felony list a mile long: murder, arson, kidnapping, terrorism, you name it. He's the most dangerous and brilliant criminal mind I've ever known. For years I've been watching him, tracking him, studying his every move. I know his every mannerism, facial tic, gesture. I know him better than he knows himself. And now, after all this time, I finally figured out a way to trap him. I will become him.
Well, I was too young for Wild at Heart, I think. But Face Off, I saw on VHS after it got released in the cinema. Con Air, same thing. Like, all this typical 90s action blockbuster things were just part of my childhood. Which is a very specific age, because he also, well, we'll get into that later, but he changes during his career. There are different, quite literal, faces of Cage.
Turns into John Travolta there. Yeah.
yeah. That's the weirdest thing about that film, is that the best performance in that movie is John Travolta acting like Nicolas Cage. Yeah, it's a bit of a problem, because Nicolas Cage as John Travolta is not that interesting, really. But anyway, I wanted to, like, kind of whiff. Well, of course, I don't do a program to watch film myself at cinema. I wanted to sort of make sense of what he was together with our audience, and see if it is more than just the madness and the things that we know of him online, and the extremities that. Also, something like the film that was released, I think, 2 years ago, The Unbearable Lightness of...
Weight of Massive Talent.
Or being Nicolas Cage, yeah. Which almost takes that entire thing and then...
It capitalizes on it in a way that I thought was kind of boring and flat.
Yeah. But, you know, so I think that was kind of the start of it. And then I tried to find... you can never really do full justice to his body of work, but I tried to, like, get the nuggets that were available and make it as... I think it's 14 films that we're screening right now, or 15 maybe even now. I hope it's a good representation of what all those different phases of his career the energy that he emanates.
Well, we have a perfect test subject, because yes. Sophie, in preparation of this, I mean, like, I lived and breathed, you know, the gospel of Cage, and Tom obviously has, if he programmed all these films. Mm. However, in preparation of this episode, you watched a lot of them for the first time.
A lot of them, yes. Yes.
How are you feeling? How are you doing?
I'm recuperating, feels like. I haven't watched any in 2 days. Before that, I watched 8 Nicolas Cage films in 9 days, which was quite intense. I actually recognize a lot of things that you just talked about, because before that, Nicolas Cage to me was just this guy that just is everywhere. And I kind of, like, with what I had with the Tom Cruise episode, I thought beforehand that I wouldn't have to watch as many films, because I probably saw a lot of them already, because it just feels like he's everywhere.
Cultural osmosis almost.
Yeah, like, I just know him. He's everywhere. I've seen him everywhere, probably mostly because of the memes. But then I actually looked at what he's been in, and I've barely seen anything. I mean, with him specifically, there's just too much to watch. But I've never really looked at him as an actor. Like, I kind of just want to end the sentence there, but I don't know if that's really what I want to say. But this was the first time that I really focused on how he is as an actor and like really focusing on him. And it was really interesting. I actually really, really enjoyed it. I always thought that he was a bad actor. I think that most people kind of go into that because of his memification. But then I went through all these films and I was like, wow, he's really not a bad actor. I think he's great.
Is there one of the films that you saw that really stuck out so that the listeners understand kind of like what made you change your perception of him?
Honestly, I think it happened right with the first one. I started with Raising Arizona and...
Son, you got a panty on your head. Just drive fast, eh?
Turn to the right!
The first time I met Ed was in the county lockup in Tempe, Arizona.
You're a flower, you are.
A day I'll never forget.
I do.
You bet I do.
Okay, then.
My lawless years were behind me. Our child-rearing years lay ahead. But... biology conspired to keep us childless.
You go right back up there and get me a toddler. I need a baby hide. I got more than I can handle.
At the time, Ed's little plan seemed like the solution to all our problems. And the answer to all our prayers.
He's beautiful.
What? Are you kidding? We got us a family here.
I want Nathan Jr. back.
What's his name?
Ed Jr.
Hi, Junior.
So far, we've just been using Junior.
We call him Junior.
He's out there somewhere.
Hold on, Nathan. We're going to go pick up Daddy.
I'll be taking these Huggies and whatever cash you got.
Which is it's really funny, great film.
That film is a hoot and a holler.
Absolutely.
And a Holly Hunter.
Yeah. Nice.
And I think immediately, because I mean, now we get into quite a philosophical question, but what is bad acting? I mean, for him, I immediately noticed that it's maybe not conventional acting, but he really puts everything, he puts all of himself into it, and he really believes what he's doing. And to me, that is great acting, I think.
Yeah, that's why I really connected him to, you know, Buster Keaton and the Three Stooges and Chaplin, and but even also in a sense, Elvis Presley in this kind of like maximalist mode. And I really liked the observation of the war on naturalism.
The war naturalism, yeah.
Which is so good because it reinforces the idea that naturalism is also a convention. It's a style. It's a norm as well in certain types of cinema, and it's one that can also be boring because within naturalism there's also people that overact, that act too much, that are not good at these simple things. But actually to go, okay, let's overact without naturalism, it becomes interesting because if there's no, you know, if there's no ceiling almost, if you have all that space in front of the camera, how do you utilize it, right? It's a huge question.
And I think this is really interesting because I've written about this a lot during my studies about how realism is a style, and I really like films that aren't made to be naturalistic, but I'd never thought about doing that within acting.
Mm-hmm.
So this really opened my eyes.
Maybe a bit of a side note, but have we all seen Poor Things?
Yes.
Yes.
So while watching Poor Things, I leaned into one of my best friends and I said to her, how is Mark Ruffalo getting away with this performance? Because that is like, it's the same sort of strange, over-the-top, full-pool, oddball comedic acting that wouldn't get nominated for an Oscar in any world. But it does because it works.
It's the same. It's the same with what Willem Dafoe can do as well. Mark Ruffalo can do it as well. And it's, I think you have to be so incredibly comfortable with what you are and how you can present a character through all this excess and to actually indulge in the excess. And that's, I think, where Cage really accelerates as well, to take all the extremities of a character and let them coexist at the same time at the same spot, which is, to quote Ferrari, my recent, you know, Michael Mann love, that there can't be two objects occupying the same space in the same time. But the interesting I think about Nicolas Cage is that he makes it seem as if it can, as if the character can have all of these different things happening at the same time.
But isn't it also that bad acting maybe is the step before Nicolas Cage and Mark Ruffalo? And when you go into that stratosphere, it's not bad anymore. It's just what you always call vibey movies. Yeah. It just becomes vibe. It becomes performance. And then that is in itself inherently a new reality,
yeah,
or something.
And so Cage, you know, this is kind of like Cage 101, but he calls his acting style nouveau shamanic because he takes a lot of...
Yeah,
like,
or Western Kabuki, which I also...
Yeah, Western
like,
Kabuki.
What the hell is
yeah,
that?
Because it's like it takes inspiration from, like, let's say more like traditional, almost folkloristic performance styles, almost ritual theater, the way that that's connected to kind of like the spiritual component, and then channeled through the sources of inspiration of expressionist cinema. So he takes a lot of inspiration from Weimar era German films, like, you know.
Yeah, that's why I mentioned Nosferatu, because there's clearly like
Nosferatu,
Max Schreck in Vampire's Kabinett, Kiss,
there's
right?
Dr. Caligari. Yeah. It's all of these kind of like heavily stylized performances that come from experimental theater at the beginning of the 20th century of Europe, which is a time where in theater world, so many things happened that broke with realist conventions. Most of that is eventually attributed to Bertolt Brecht, but in that time, so many things were happening, and all of these things ending up in a guy who comes from this movie excellence family. You know, his uncle is Francis Ford Coppola, and then removing himself from that family association and making it entirely his own and navigating Hollywood and all of these different types of movies, like Jerry Bruckheimer action flicks in the 90s, crazy Coen brother movies, collaborations with David Lynch. Somehow his mood and his style can complement all of these different types of films. That's quite incredible. That's always kind of what got to me at the beginning when I started my blog, was like, this guy is like the perfect entry point into actually learning what cinema is in a mainstream way, I guess. It was very useful.
No, I completely now knowing you as a friend, I completely understand how you come to what you like now.
Yeah, stepping stone.
Yeah, because that his way of performing and the movies that he gives this weird energy to are... It's a very freeing way of watching film that comes out of that, if this is what brought you up.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
I was actually wondering, because as I just said, for me, it really took sitting down and focusing on him to see kind of his genius. What was the entry point for you? What was the film that you saw where you thought, ooh, I need to focus on this guy?
I think it was Bad Lieutenant, Port of Call, New Orleans.
The good news, Terrence, is I'll okay you to return to full duty. The bad news is that you'll be experiencing moderate to severe back pain.
Recognition of his leadership and tenacity, Lieutenant Terrence McDonough.
This is who we're looking for. Name is Donald Godshaw.
You up to this?
Why wouldn't I be?
Still having problems with your back? You taking medication for it?
Only what the doctor prescribes.
Got any illegal substances on you?
Whoa. Big mistake.
Who are you?
I'm Dave, the guy you robbed. To make it right, you gotta come up with $50,000. Don't make me look for you, Terrence.
You mind stepping outside? I'd like to talk to you. I'm gonna give you a chance to make some money the old-fashioned way. With a cop protecting you.
You a crazy man.
Really kind of like... brought me at a point where I was like, okay, no, I need to commit myself to him now, because I was really, when I was a teenager, obsessed with Werner Herzog, and I watched Aguirre, Der Zorn Gottes, and I was like obsessed with that movie.
We have not forgotten that it was your password.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, thanks for reminding everybody
again.
Of
course,
and then I remembered like finding that film in like a DVD budget bin for like €2, and I bought it and I put it on and I was blown away. Not like also really very much by the film, and everybody that has seen it, you know, knows the breakdancing guy whose soul is still in his body.
Shoot him again.
What
for? His soul's still dancing.
The iguana. Oh, yeah.
What are these fucking iguanas doing on my coffee table?
What are these fucking iguanas doing on my coffee table?
But then him shouting at this elderly lady and like being all coked up and all this insane energy, and he just, Herzog draws it out of him, but he also very much gives something of himself to that film, because you see that kind of like creative collaboration. Mm. And that just was so fascinating to me. And then I think it spiraled and I got really interested in all of his films. And then I started writing about it. And then I just figured I can watch all of them indiscriminately, because they're all kind of interesting, even if they're for some objectively shit. Mm-hmm. It's still worthwhile for me to watch these films, which was an interesting exercise as well. But it was definitely Bad Lieutenant. And then all the films basically that Tom programmed are films that I have very fond memories of watching. You know, these are films that I've revisited so many times. So it's kind of like, for me, it feels like this, we've often talked in this podcast about nostalgia, but this is like a full circle moment almost for me, that we're sitting here discussing some of these films that have meant so much to me when I just started out doing the things that I'm doing. So that's it's quite special. Do you have like a film, Tom, that you were like...
Yeah, I'm wondering, because it must be one of these sort of late 90s, mid 90s action film thingies. So it's either, I think it's either Face Off or The Rock.
His name is John Mason, British national, incarcerated on Alcatraz in 1962, escaped in 63. There's no identity in the United States or Great Britain. He does not exist.
Secrets have a way of coming back to haunt you.
There's a hostage situation on Alcatraz.
Hostage?
81 tourists.
The Rock's a tourist attraction.
The one you train to defend you becomes your greatest threat.
A battery of VX gas rockets is presently deployed to deliver a highly lethal strike on the population of the San Francisco Bay Area.
And the one you abandon becomes your only hope.
You go talk to him.
Me?
Yeah.
Hiya. I'm an agent with the FBI. I'm Stanley Goodspeed.
But of course you are.
At least he got his name right.
Now, all that stands between a city and a disaster.
The power of this chemical is way beyond anything you can imagine.
That's why you're coming with us.
Is a man who's never seen combat.
You're a chemical freak. I'm a chemical super freak, actually.
And another who's been out of action for 30 years.
Show us on the blueprints.
I can't. My blueprint was in my head.
Fortunately, some things you never forget.
But don't worry. It'll all come back to me.
Welcome to The Rock. Because The Rock has my... That's one of my... So the issue with The Rock is that Nicolas Cage stars along a guy who can steal any frame just by being Sean Connery. And The Rock is just... I used to think that The Rock was a stupid film because it's a Jerry Bruckheimer. Don Simpson is still alive then, I think. So it's the production duo who made these huge blockbusters with Michael Bay, and they have a very clear style and they're super bombastic and only ever so slightly comedic, but they take themselves really seriously, and there's always a shot of helicopters coming over a horizon. But The Rock, about it's a general who takes over Alcatraz, and then Nicolas Cage plays a scientist called something Goodspeed. I can't remember what his first name is.
Stanley
Goodspeed. Yeah. To this day, I still have a friend who, when we say goodbye to each other, we say Goodspeed instead of Godspeed. And then they have to get Sean Connery plays this. We're not going to mention he's James Bond, but he could be James Bond, but he's locked up kind of character who needs to help them because he's the only guy who escaped from Alcatraz, or blah, 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 blah. And it becomes this super high stakes action movie. And it's beautiful how Nick Cage and Sean Connery have rapport on screen. I don't know what it is. I don't know why it works, but it looks like they're having a really good time. And it ends up having one of my favorite quotes from a film ever, I think, is when Nick Cage says they have to go into the building where the general is at, and they're having this moment, and Nick Cage says, "I'll do my best," and then Sean Connery says, "Your best." Losers always whine about their best. Winners go home and fuck the prom queen. Okay. And then, yeah, it's like, wow. And then Nick Cage looks at him and says, sorry if this is not her name, but he looks at her, at Sean Connery, and says, Donna was the prom queen. I was like,
you sure you're ready for this?
I'll do my best.
Your best? Losers always whine about their best. Winners go home and fuck the prom queen.
Carla was the prom queen.
Really?
Yeah.
This is the most 90s Michael Bay buff macho man thing in a film ever.
But it's like he's
it makes no
but he's
sense.
Pretty he's really fucking good at also playing the dork and kind owning that, which is I find always very funny, because there's very specific films where he kind of becomes this the Sean Connery type, you know, hero. And you know, I really love the National Treasure movies.
Treasure Protectors. All his life, Benjamin Gates has searched for a treasure no one believed existed.
Don't you get it, Ben? The treasure is a myth.
Yeah, I refuse to believe that. But what he thought was the final clue...
108 years of searching and I'm 3 feet away.
...is only the beginning.
The Declaration of Independence.
You think there is a treasure map on the back of the Declaration of Independence?
The map is invisible.
Oh. Why would we make this up?
Where's your proof?
We don't have it.
Did Bigfoot take it?
Which are like the... Like, I would say better films than Indiana Jones, but for me, but like, he's very much, you know, the family friendly hero, you know, he owns that role as well. But him in the more beta guck, like, loser role is also very funny, because he can do that as well. He can look like a whimpering dog, you know.
I mean, he's great in adaptation.
To begin. Coffee would help me think. Coffee and a muffin. I'm going up to Santa Barbara this Saturday, and I was wondering.
Oh.
I'm sorry.
So I'll just be right back with your pie then.
Drum roll, please. I'm going to be a screenwriter, like you. I'm putting in a chase sequence. So the killer flees on horseback, cops after them on a motorcycle. And it's like a battle between motors and horses, like technology versus horse.
Susan, we would really like to option this. You want to make it into a movie?
I want to know what it feels like to care about something passionately. Don LaRoche is a tall guy, sharply handsome.
The book has no story. There's no story.
Make one up.
Okay, we open with LaRoche.
No,
we open at the beginning of time. Okay, we open with LaRoche.
Crazy white man.
We open on Charlie Kaufman.
Fat, bald, ugly, paces.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's pointing
and I think that...
Did you watch that film?
I have
Sophie?
Seen it.
Because
it was
that's like double Cage immediately as well.
I think this was one of the first films where... But I can't remember. I saw it a long time
ago. Your ears
ago.
And eyes started to bleed like that.
Yeah, I saw it in... I was in class. We had to watch it in class. So that is, for me, never a great setting to watch a film. And so I was immediately disengaged. But I think that was the first film I've seen with him in it, which was probably a good film with him in it. So I definitely need to rewatch it. But I thought, you know, I need to save some films to still watch here
in
the cinema.
Yeah, we're screening it in a new 4K restoration, which I'm really happy with. But of course, adaptation, even without Nicolas Cage, is a great film. But he just adds to it playing Charlie Kaufman, the writer of Being John Malkovich. And then it also being about the taping of John Malkovich, but he's writing a different screenplay about a book that's what was the book again? It's a book, but then you also see the book being played out with Meryl Streep and Chris Cooper. It's something, the Orchid Hunter or something like that.
The only thing I remember about this film is just being confused.
Yeah, because the book that he's trying to base the screenplay on then also becomes reality.
The
Orchid Thief, exactly, yeah. And then he has a brother who's this super obnoxious guy who also wants to write screenplays. And so it's Nicolas Cage playing against Nicolas Cage as his brother, his stupid brother. And he says like, hey man, can you give me an idea I'm trying to write a screenplay about a serial killer, but I wanted to give it this edge to it. And I think then super annoyed Charlie Kaufman, Nicolas Cage, says something like, he cuts the people up and he spreads the parts around town, and that's his obsession. And just like, oh, that's really good. I'm gonna feature that in my screenplay. And he was like, fuck, that's the dumbest idea ever. But he's now gonna feature it, and then of course it becomes a success. This is the sadness of adaptation. And he's, as you say, very good at playing this sad, depressed slob. That he's also kind of in Leaving Las Vegas, where he has the exact same balding hairstyle as in. I was doing the editing for the trailer, and he almost looks exactly the same.
Such a crummy balding head, like he. Yeah. Have you seen Leaving Las Vegas, Sophie?
I have. Yeah. Yeah. This is a thing that I actually wrote in one of my last reviews or first reviews on Letterboxd, that I have decided that I hate his hair. I don't know. It's just. It's such a thing about him.
It's like
even
he's got a lot
of
hair. Even if he doesn't have a lot of hair, it feels like there's a lot of hair going on.
Yeah. He seems to be balding, but he still has a lot of hair.
Yeah. It's interesting. I hate it.
I really love Leaving Las Vegas for kind of like the it's a very gutsy film also in that era for Mike Figgis. And I think it's also a film where you see his silliness, but it's cloaked in so much depression and alcoholism, and that he finds a way to take all that excess and then show us that it's channeled through insane depression, which is a very like interesting, daring artistic choice as well for him, because he takes that energy and he, you know, fuels it through a profoundly sad thing. It's because there's very funny moments in that film, but then it's also like heartbreakingly sad.
Yeah. I was really surprised by this film and also Bad Lieutenant, because they were both quite calm performances by him.
Yeah.
Quite, I'm looking for the right word, but
they show a certain restraint.
Yeah, exactly. He's known for his like big bombastic like outbursts. And there were a few in both of those films, but they were so restrained and well chosen, I would say.
That except when he's on the crack.
I mean, but then he's on drugs, so why not?
I love that moment that Exhibit looks at him and goes like, what the hell is he talking about? And then you hear a guy who's standing, like one of the other thugs, just screams, that's the crack talking.
Yeah.
And it certainly is.
Yeah. But I thought that was beautiful. Leaving Las Vegas, it was a beautiful film, yeah.
For that film, there's a moment where he drinks a beer underwater in the swimming pool.
Yeah.
I did that once, really hard to do. It's almost impossible. But it was a very inspiring moment in Leaving Las Vegas.
I can imagine. Yeah, no, it only goes to show how much skill you need to be a good actor.
Yeah, exactly. And how influential he is to anybody's life.
But that's kind of like I referenced that in my cold open, that when he was cast for Rumblefish, the Francis Ford Coppola film, which is this kind of like finger snapping, you know, teenage rival gangs in this kind of like West Side Story-ish world, very much 1950s Hollywood, but then filmed in the 80s. It's a very like stylized film. And when they were looking for one of the roles, he, you know, went to the casting, and he went to the casting as just an anonymous guy, basically, not as I am the nephew, just really on his own name with his own, like really putting in the work. And you can draw this connection between that film, which is scenery chewing, you know, to have such a presence on set, in front of the camera, to have all these fluid body movements, to bounce around the stage. That's kind of a thing that he's really good at. And then you see it in Leaving Las Vegas when he's high or whatever, or when he's like very drunk and this energy comes back. You see it very much in Raisin Arizona or in Vampire's Kiss. You know, this is a film where he is bitten by somebody after a party in a nightclub in New York. And, you know, he has this job that in like a literary publisher or something, and he's depressed with it. And then he believes that he's turning into a vampire, and it gives this new gush of energy in his life. And suddenly all these constraints in that life, the office, the job, his home, all these things, he kind of almost breaks out of it like this. And it's so pleasing to see him transform himself in that film into Nicolas Cage almost, right? Into the cliched version of himself. It makes sense that these moments then become reduced to memes like I did, you know, with the ABCs and Not the Bees, which, by the way, I find the Wicker Man remake a very nice film. It's a very fun film. I actually like it a lot, not only for the meme aspects, but also the way that the film is shot and the things. It's a good film. I would say it's also very underrated.
It's a film that really suffers under that meme.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, not even in the version that you can see right now anymore. Yeah. It's in another cut.
It's in the cut that's now on the DVD because, like, I think they figured out that
Now the movie is more important because of one moment all the way in the end. What you said about Bad Lieutenant and this sort of understated performance that you expect something being way more intense.
Mm.
How do you guys think that, like, the films like that we're also screening, like Pig and Mandy, like newer films where... which are very intense in a way, but the performances where you expect him to maybe go berserk again are very sort of understated. And it's almost like I was like last night I was thinking about the whole reconnaissance thing, right? Yeah. That an actor can start out somewhere and then evolve into something more intellectually accepted or something. Hasn't Cage done that already? And isn't it like every time that a new film comes out where he's more serious, we go like, oh yeah, well this is a good Nicolas Cage movie again, which almost sort of is taking the piss out of the work where he is very sort of performative.
This is ultimately, I think, one of my biggest problems with the whole memeified thing, even though it is funny, but
it doesn't respect him as an actor.
Exactly
really.
What you say. It's like to go back to a more naturalist mode doesn't mean, and it comes back to your question of what's good and bad acting, it doesn't mean that it is better per se, you know?
Yeah. Right.
Because like, I remember when Joe came out, this film, and he has a very, like, let's say, serious naturalistic role in that film as this kind of like loner guy in this like flyover state America, and this kid played by Tyler Sheridan becomes kind of like his, they get this special bond. And he is Joe in the film. The film is named after his character. So it's like, he's kind of like the main attraction of that film because he is Nicolas Cage and he's in a restrained mode. It's a good film, but
hated that film.
I like it, but it's like, it's a good film, but all the other stuff is, or many of the other films are also good. So it's like a false dichotomy, you know?
Yeah, but also, well, with that film, maybe, so with David Gordon Green, right? The guy who also directed the new Halloween remakes. Not that that makes him a better director. I didn't like that because at that point, the attraction of that film was almost, here's Nicolas Cage underperforming.
Yeah.
And the rest of that film wasn't interesting, to me at least. Like, I was like, okay, so this is it?
I haven't seen it in ages.
Has this become the attraction of a film that it's Nicolas Cage not doing the ABCs?
Yeah.
Like, it's Nicolas Cage not looking like he's completely coked up? Like, it does this weird thing. I'm not sure. It doesn't really help him. I'm very happy that he doesn't... It still looks like his... Even now in his career... He doesn't seem to be, he seems to be more aware of the meme, of the image that people have of him being this very extreme actor.
The unbearable, massive.
Exactly, yeah.
He went on SNL to do a sketch about himself as well.
Yeah.
Nice. Well, that's funny.
I was reading up this New York Times interview from a while back. The interviewer asks him about his early days when he was extremely performative on Letterman already, yeah, like talking about all these bizarre things that he'd done and like his pet cobras attacking him and, has, and doing like, drugs with his cats and blah, blah, blah.
There's this very famous like hit public TV, you know, appearance of him where like he's announced and he just kind of like crashes on the stage. Like he just like, like the Tom Cruise bouncing on the couch thing, but then like his entire kind of like entrance is just like just jumping and crazy, and it's just one burst of energy immediately, like unrestrained.
Yeah, but so I think he has always been very, you know, is it our fault or did he did he make the persona?
What doesn't help is that, you know, many people watch some of his films, I guess, when they're on TV, like in on some commercial channel in the Netherlands or whatever, or see them in DVD bins back in the days, or now see some stuff on streamers that comes from this very specific era that I think we have to mention, which is like him being very much in debt because he just overbought and over like spent so much in his life that he couldn't also be very picky. You know, beggars can't be choosers. And there was definitely a moment where he almost had to jump on any role that was being offered to him because he had so many bills to pay off for the dino skull, $2 million.
He is like a huge nerd.
Yeah.
He's like a huge comic book nerd. Mm-hmm. Yeah. His son is called Kal-El, like the original name that Superman, has on Krypton. So he is a super nerd. He and as I said before we started recording, he bought Action Comics 1, like the one of the most limited first Superman comics ever, for $150,000. And then, yes, of course, he bought the donkey, the dino skull for $2 million, outbidding. Who do you think he outbid? Who else would buy a dino skull? It's not something that somebody you'd really expect to do that.
Yeah, that's a good question.
How are we supposed to guess then?
Yeah, Johnny Depp or something.
Leonardo DiCaprio.
Oh, okay. Oh. So that's pretty close.
Yeah. But Johnny Depp does seem like a more unhinged person, like a couple of bottles of wine and a dino skull. Yeah. So that's of course probably is the main reason why at some point he started being in so many straight to DVD and straight to VHS films.
And so what I wanted to do in this episode is take the opportunity to also champion some of these films, because they're not in your program, which is totally fine and I understand. But in those 120 movies, there are still gems and nuggets in an era where he not always had the luxury to work with the most renowned directors like I mentioned. And have you seen any of the stuff that was not on this list that made an impression on you, or is this an aspect of Cage that you're not entirely familiar
I thought that these would be the films that I probably had seen somewhere, but I think I fully skipped this this period of him.
Well, you were waiting for Sophie to say, like, I am a huge fan of the Ghost Rider franchise.
For instance, I love those movies. Yeah, that would be like, there's...
No, I'm sorry. I don't think I've seen those.
That's forgiven. I mean, there's plenty to dive into still. And I wanted to give one recommendation, and Tom, maybe you have one of those as well, these kind of like direct DVD ones. But a one that I'm very fond of is Knowing.
The theory of randomness says it's all simply coincidence. There is no grand meaning, making it possible for you to be sitting here in this riveting lecture.
50 years ago, the students of William Dawes Elementary imagined what the future might hold. Today, we unveiled their legacy.
Okay, why are you showing me this?
It's a list of dates. Every major global disaster for the last 50 years in perfect sequence. From a piece of paper that's been buried in the ground for 5 decades. The next number on the chain predicts that tomorrow, 81 people are going to die in some kind of tragedy.
Get off the train.
Why? What's wrong?
Just take the baby and get off the train.
Estimates put the presumed dead at 81.
Prediction came true. It's not coincidence.
from 2009 by Alex Proyas. Who did,
by
the way...
Is it Alex Proyas,
yeah,
really?
He did Dark City and iRobot and The Crow.
And he waged a war on film critics. Let's
really
not forget. Yes, oh. When he made Gods of Egypt, right?
There's a lot of war.
Gods of Egypt, yeah.
That got reviews that were so terrible that he, quite literally almost waged a war on film critics.
Good for him. He's right. He's right.
which period of him are we talking about?
This is 2009. So now we're in the...
And until when did this period go on? When
that's a good question.
Yeah, died down a bit.
It died down a bit because in 2011 he did the Werner Herzog film, and I think that was...
And he did pay off his debts. He's out of...
Is he completely out of debt?
Well, yes, he's out of
Nick,
debt.
Nick, listen, congratulations.
Good for you, my friend.
No, but also there's this... still, there's now a Western right now being released that nobody will probably see. So
he's still
doing these things that you go like, wait, what? I love this. I love looking up actors and going like, what the hell are you playing now?
Actors also just want to act, I think. But in the case of Knowing, so this is a film from 2009 where he's an MIT professor, and due to some circumstances, there's this list of numbers and they're kind of like this cipher riddle thing. But he can use the numbers to know things that happened in the past, but also predict things that will happen in the future. And then, of course, there's like an earth, shattering event that is going to happen that he can stop. And it's, your classic kind of like me against the world. Maybe I'm paranoid, but maybe I'm also like a sage and a prophet and I can save the entire world and humanity thing.
I think I've actually seen this.
And then in the middle of the movie, Sophie, maybe you remember this, there's like this absolutely fantastic scene where a plane crashes, which is a thing that he had kind of already known that would happen, and that I think strengthens this character in the film to know that he can actually prevent catastrophes because he knew that the plane was going to crash.
Right.
And the plane crash is on a very shoestring budget, very well done. It's a really intense scene. It's him in his more conventional mode, I would say, but it is a very, very good film. And he's also very good in these modes. Like he can do an adventure movie. He can do a sci-fi movie. Like I said, with, National Treasure, he can run on screen and you're interested in looking at him. That's and he does a lot of that in the film. Do you have one, Tom?
Yeah, but I just realized that it doesn't really fit this bill in that period of time. But because I was also thinking about this. Are there any movies that I want to discuss that are not in this program because they are just not good enough to be in the program? And I want to do one small shout out to the beautiful but completely obsolete remake of Der Himmel über Berlin.
Oh, yes, that's a great film.
Sorry. City of Angels.
City of Angels, yes.
So it's just Wings of Desire by Wim Wenders, but then remade with Meg Ryan and Nicolas Cage.
In a place called the City of Angels, one of us,
Dr. Rice,
go.
300,
is about to meet one of them.
Have you ever been seen, Cassio? Have you ever been seen like you were a man?
Come on, don't do that.
He's going.
He's not going anywhere.
That doctor in the operating room, she looked right at me.
She didn't see you, Seth. She can't see you. No one can see you unless you want them to.
And if I want her to?
What do you want to do?
And it's just the dumbest idea ever, but it's just, I think he comes off face off and probably his agent says, well, let's do something art housey, but still incredibly American. You're going to play an angel who wants to be a human. What I like about the film is that it proves that when you have a really good film, you can't necessarily fit it into the American dream and then come out clean. It's just a stupid film, but I think I've seen it multiple times on VHS when I was really young.
It's a stupid but lovely movie.
And then the movie that he makes after that is 8mm with Joel Schumacher.
Wow, yeah.
One of the dirtiest, nastiest thrillers
from
that era.
Movie, yeah.
Find the guys who made this film is going to be very difficult.
I need information. I thought you might be able to help.
You name the vice, I name the price. I'm gonna tell you, there's things that you're gonna see that you can't unsee. They get in your head and they stay there.
Some doors should never be opened.
Tom, where are you?
You dance with the devil. The devil don't change. The devil changes you.
Because once you go through...
I'm gonna be okay.
There is no going back.
The last film that I saw by him, just to kind of try to cleanse my palate, but I don't know if that worked, which goes back to a question that you asked in the beginning about the sort of final era of Cage. It was Renfield that came out like 2 years ago.
Oh, with him being the
Dracula,
vampire. Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
I haven't even seen that one.
Which I think fits in with the unbearable weight of massive talent, that it goes into this era of him knowing that he is Nicolas Cage and kind of playing...
capitalizing.
Nicolas Cage instead of playing a role.
Right,
and we talked about this a few weeks ago. I asked, because then the only film I remembered watching with Nicolas Cage in it was The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent. And I asked you, Ucho, what you thought of that, and you said that you didn't like it because he was playing Nicolas
Cage. No, I haven't seen it.
Oh.
I didn't like the idea, so I didn't watch it.
Yeah, and when you said that, I didn't fully understand what that meant.
Yeah.
But now, having watched all his films, I do fully agree with this.
Oh,
it's really, really fun to see Nicolas Cage play a character and not play himself. Mm.
To actually do the work, you know, just the real work of acting, which is just this magical thing. And like, I think he shines light to what a specific part of that magic is.
Absolutely, yeah. I feel like we can keep talking about him forever. There's just so much to say, but having touched upon now this sort of final stage of Cage, maybe we can just briefly look at the future of Cage. Like, where is he going from here?
That's an interesting question.
Because I've also heard, I think I've read something about him wanting to quit acting because there's nothing new for him to do anymore.
Really?
Or maybe going into TV rather than films, because his whole sort of acting style is built on doing something new.
That's interesting.
Well, I'm still, there's one film coming up this year called Long Legs by Oz Perkins, which is kind of like this thriller movie that seems quite interesting because it has this very heavy style. It sounds like this pretty creepy film, which, like you mentioned, 8mm, and I love him in these films where it gets in slightly depraved territories. Well, he can do that as well, this kind of terror, you know. So this is a film that I'm actually very excited about him starring in. But yeah, I mean, it's a good point. I've always wondered this with some of these people that just don't stop acting. Like this year, you know, Michael Caine is in a film called The Great Escaper that gets a release in a month. And I'm wondering, like, why he says, like, this will be my final film, which is also, that film is not going to be a good film.
He said that 4 years ago.
He said that, like, they keep saying it and then they just start in something quite shitty. So maybe they can't, how do you stop being an actor is such a good question.
Yeah, but I mean,
well,
like, there are many with Cage and with actors like this, I always have to think about a documentary about Rutger Hauer called Blonde Hair, Blue Eyes. And it's a young female director who follows him around for quite a long time. And at some point, she's on the set with him of, I think, Football Manager 3, The Story of Soccer. Like, clearly a film made for a bargain bin. But he acts his ass off, and then he gets to his trailer, and she just says to him, like, Rutger, why are you doing this? And he looks at her in this enigmatic Rutger Hauer way and then just says, I just like the work. And I think, always think that Nicolas Cage, when I see like this Western, I can't remember what the name is, that's also now released, that gets a 5 on IMDb. I'm like, yeah, probably he just likes to do the stuff, but then where does it lead? I don't want it to lead to what you said, like him playing in the thriller that's really grim and dirty, and then doing the Renfield 2 thing where he's like super Nick Cage, being Nick Cage, vampires kiss craziness. I would like like him to be in something, maybe a bit more adaptation thing, where it can be a bit more in the middle of those, of the idea that we have of him and his abilities as an actor can go both ways, into the extreme and into maybe the more serious territory.
He definitely has the range. And what my, you know, always my thing was that I came back to in my early Nicolas Cage blog was that...
it's cute. Please keep really, saying this.
It's really a matter of like how a director utilizes the energy that is in such a an artist as Cage, you know, and there's many others like him that have a energy. And so... you have to have the right people that draw it out, and you have the right projects. And then, I don't know, it's like you can't always make a masterpiece. You can't always work with the greatest directors on earth. But there's moments where it suddenly clicks. And when you do, that's when the real magic happens. And I don't know, like, how can I predict what he's going to do? But every time those elements combine, you know that a thing is going to happen. And it doesn't necessarily have to be a good film. But you know for sure that it's going to be an interesting one, which is probably always the best thing.
Yeah, I think that's a beautiful note to end this on.
Yay, nice.
Yay. So for now, you can focus on Dream Scenario, which will be playing here starting...
March 14th, if I'm correct. I'm correct.
All right, starting March 14th.
Yeah, and we got a couple of early previews the 2 weeks before the release date.
All right. Tickets for that can be found on the Lab 111 website. If you enjoyed this episode and want to hear more about iconic acting, you can listen to our episode Tilda Swinton, Renaissance Woman, Chameleon and Muse on your podcast platform of choice or on our website. Also, we have some very exciting news. After our screenings and live recordings of Twilight and Princess Mononoke last year, we enjoyed speaking to you so much that we are starting our very own bi-monthly Celebrating Cinema Film Club. Films picked and introduced by us, followed by a drink and a chat at the bar. Keep an eye out on the Lab 111 website for more information soon. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review and share so more people can find us. Make sure to subscribe and stay up to date with all new releases. For any questions, feedback, or requests, contact us at celebratingcinema@lab111.nl and follow us at Lab111 on Instagram. As always, we provide show notes, including all films mentioned, at celebratingcinema.com. This was a Lab 111 production, edited and produced by Elliot Bloom, with music from Hugo Emmerzaal and artwork by Studio FFF.
Yay!
Yay! Thank you.